Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
It's Kelly Clarkson here to talk all things Wayfair, the best place to buy furniture, decor, and anything else you can think of to create a home you absolutely love. I know when I shop with Wayfair, I find options for every style, whether I'm feeling boho or farmhouse, modern, traditional, French country. I can find exactly what I need for my home and more. No matter your space, style, or budget, shop Wayfair.com to make your home way more you.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
It was a sunny spring day when 18-year-old Julie Connell decided to spend time in the park with her favorite book in hand. She was an honor student, a loving sister, and an ambitious girl with a bright future. But when her family came to pick her up, Julie was no longer there. She had vanished forever. Imagine a high school senior who is a role model for everyone. She's smart, composed, always has an opinion on any matter, and many look up to her. That's exactly who Julie N. Connell was. Help this channel grow. Like the video, try the new hype feature, leave a comment, and subscribe for more stories. This helps us a lot. Thank you. Julie was born on April 15, 1966, and was the eldest daughter of Jim and Kathy Connell. The family lived in San Leandro, California, a city located in the eastern part of the San Francisco Bay Area. It was the kind of place where families felt safe, leaving their doors unlocked. The city streets were lined with well-kept lawns, and children played in the yards. Here and there, neighbors exchanged greetings. The city's population had grown significantly over the past few decades, reaching over 60,000 in the 1980s. The Connell family home was an oasis of love and mutual respect. They lived in a cozy suburban neighborhood, and Julie fully embraced this stability, focusing entirely on her studies and passions. She was a diligent student, and at the same time, possessed a quiet determination and a spark in her eyes that made people take notice of her. Julie was an honor student at Royal High School. Not only did her teachers adore her, but her classmates saw her as a sincere, kind person they could always rely on. Her younger sisters, Wendy and Patricia, practically idolized Julie. School wasn't the only thing that interested the teenager. Connell loved reading, writing, and performing on stage. She dreamed of becoming a television host in the future. Julie had a boyfriend, Tom O'Neill. He was slightly older than her and already in college. The young couple spent a lot of time together, enjoying each other's company. When Julie turned 18, it was a huge milestone for her. 18 is the age when you start to feel like an adult. Connell had already bought her cap and gown for graduation and paid for a class trip to Disneyland. On April 15th, her birthday, Julie spent the day with her boyfriend, Tom. Just a few months earlier, she had been accepted to California State University in Hayward. She had big plans, and no one doubted she would achieve them all. Julie was simply brilliant. She devoted a lot of time to charity and caring for others, volunteering at the local church and reading Bible stories to children. Her family and friends, everyone who knew Julie closely, were certain she was on the cusp of great accomplishments. Of course, Connell was just an ordinary high school senior, someone's sister, friend, and daughter. That's why the story of what happened to her touches the heart so deeply. She simply lived her life, believing a wonderful future awaited her. A future that everyone, including her, has a right to. Julie could hardly have imagined the horror that awaited her in one of the city's safest places. On April 20th, 1984, during the Easter weekend, the weather was beautiful. The Connell family planned to spend the day together. Kathy, the mother, wanted to take her three daughters to the movies to see Police Academy. But it turned out Julie had already seen the film, so she had slightly different plans. While her sisters, 15-year-old Wendy and 12-year-old Patricia, laughed at the comedy and ate popcorn with their mom, Julie decided to use the time for reading. College was just around the corner, and she wasn't about to slack off, especially with a test scheduled for Monday. The girl took everything she needed, the book she was reading, water, a blanket, and a small snack. Then she put on her favorite lavender shirt, blue jeans, and white tennis shoes to be comfortable lying on the ground. Kennedy Park was right across the street from the movie theater, the perfect place to stretch out on the grass and enjoy a good book. Julie asked her mom to pick her up after the movie ended. She got out of the car around 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Her family had no idea they were seeing her alive for the last time. In the park, Julie found a comfortable spot, spread out her blanket, pulled out her book, and dove into reading. Her sister Wendy hung out nearby for a bit, waiting for the movie to start. The park was calm and peaceful. The sun was shining and it was full of people relaxing. But when the movie ended and Kathy returned to the park with the girls, Julie was gone. At first, they didn't think much of it. Maybe she went to grab a snack or got bored. Perhaps the high schooler had gone home early. Just to be safe, Kathy walked through the entire park, calling Julie's name. But neither Julie, her blanket, nor her book was anywhere to be found. When they got home, Kathy expected to see Julie and hear an explanation for why she hadn't waited for her sisters and mom. But the house was quiet, and her daughter wasn't there. With each passing minute, their anxiety grew. Jim Connell came home from work, initially angry, then nervous. This behavior was unlike his eldest daughter. Their shared worry soon turned to fear that something had happened to Julie. The parents called all her classmates and spoke to her boyfriend, Tom, but no one had seen her or had any idea where she might have gone. Then the Connells started calling local hospitals, hoping for any news about their child, but that was fruitless too. Julie had simply vanished in broad daylight. When Jim and Kathy went to the police, they were told the worst possible news. Since Julie had just turned 18, the authorities couldn't accept a missing person report for at least 72 hours because she was now considered an adult. 72 hours is an eternity when someone you love goes missing. The first 24 hours are critical for finding someone alive. With each passing hour, the chances diminish. As is often the case, law enforcement assumed the high schooler had run away from home or was simply out having fun, losing track of time. But the Connells knew their Julie wasn't reckless. She would never make her parents worry without reason. It was all terribly wrong. Naturally, the mother, father, and sisters couldn't sit idly by and do nothing. So they did what any desperate family would do. The Connells organized their own search party, printing over 2,000 flyers and posting them all over the city, begging for help. They scoured Kennedy Park, every street, every corner of their city, hoping to find any clue. On Easter Sunday morning, the Connells went to church, seeking some comfort. During the service, Jim felt something deeply unsettling. A cold, heavy wave of despair washed over him, shaking him to his core. It was like a voice whispering that Julie would never come home. At that moment, the man said nothing to anyone, still hoping for a positive outcome. But deep down, he already knew his little girl was no longer alive. The family continued their search. They had no other choice. They had to find Julie, no matter the cost. What started as an ordinary spring day turned into a nightmare for the Connell family. They lived in constant fear as time dragged on. By the third day, they were running on pure adrenaline and desperate hope. Julie had been missing for 72 hours. 3 full days of searching parks, knocking on doors, and making late-night calls, pleading for anyone who might have seen her. 3 days of replaying every detail in their minds, wondering what they had missed. Finally, the police agreed to start an investigation, but their initial response was cold, detached, and far too casual. They said the girl was probably just out with friends. The authorities brushed off the search, as if Julie had gone to an unplanned party and there was no need to worry so much. But the Connells were certain that wasn't the case. While other families prepared Easter dinner, they ran around the city, handing out flyers. Julie's face was now everywhere, in store windows, on telephone booths, even on car windshields. Her father, Jim, appeared on local television, pleading with the public for help. The search wasn't just the family's effort. The entire community came together to find the missing girl. Strangers with flashlights combed every corner of Kennedy Park and nearby areas. Psychics performed rituals to see what had happened to Julie. Search dogs tried to pick up the girl's scent. It was a whirlwind of effort, but it yielded no results. Then the first clue emerged. After seeing news reports about Julie's disappearance, a woman called the police. She thought she had found something important. It was a book, discarded in the bushes near her porch. The very book Julie had taken to the park, marked with the stamp of the school library where Julie went. The woman couldn't understand how the book ended up near her house. Before detectives could address this, another call came in. Another woman, walking with her daughter near the park, noticed a lavender shirt and a bra. The items were just lying on the street. Unfortunately, the shirt looked like the one.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
When it comes to showing appreciation, the gift you choose says everything. Minky Couture luxury blankets make the perfect statement. Soft, stylish, and unforgettable. Whether you're thanking a client, rewarding an employee, or celebrating a milestone, nothing delivers warmth and gratitude like a Minky blanket. With custom options and elegant packaging, your gift will stand out and be remembered long after the moment has passed. Make your corporate gifting extraordinary with Minky Couture. Luxury you can feel. Visit minkycouture.com to get started.
Julie was wearing. The bra was cut in the middle, its straps torn. These clues suggested something terrible had happened to the girl. When the police brought the shirt and bra to the Connells' home, Kathy and Jim were afraid to even look. The torn fabric could only mean their daughter was in trouble and they couldn't help her. The realization was terrifying. But the parents weren't about to give up until they found Julie. Jim and Kathy still believed their child was alive. 2 days later, two teenage girls reported another crucial detail. They found the missing girl's backpack under a payphone near a store. The school girls admitted they had rummaged through the backpack, looking for something valuable. They were driving and throwing out items they didn't need from the window. When they heard about Julie Connell on the news and learned she had a backpack, they told their older sister, who advised them to call the police. Each of these clues was like another breadcrumb, a glimmer of hope mixed with fear. Then, 5 days after Julie's disappearance, on April 25th, the call the parents dreaded came. A farmer and his wife were herding cattle in a remote part of Castro Valley, about 20 minutes from Kennedy Park, where Julie was last seen. The farmer explained they had come to move the cattle to another pasture when they stumbled upon a shocking sight. The body of a young woman, naked from the waist up, lay in an open area inside a corral. It was clear she was dead. The scene was chilling. The corral was surrounded by hills and dense brush. An isolated area, far from busy roads and populated places. It was unlikely anyone would end up there by chance. But it was the perfect place to hide a crime. When investigators approached the body, it was immediately clear they were dealing with a brutal murder. The woman had no identification on her, but the detectives had a gut feeling it was Julie Connell. The upper part of her body was exposed, with visible bruises and blood. The victim's throat had been slit from ear to ear. Her left wrist was tightly bound with a complex knot. Her right wrist was nearly severed. It seemed the perpetrator had tried to restrain the girl with such force that the cord cut deep into her skin. The condition of the body spoke of something horrific. There were defensive wounds on her hands and forearms, clear evidence that Julie had fought back with all her strength. There were abrasions on her knees, as if she had been dragged across the ground before being killed. A thorough examination of the body revealed that the assailant, in a fit of rage, had slashed the high schooler's throat 3 times, trying to silence her forever. Investigators meticulously combed the corral. They worked methodically, documenting every inch of the crime scene. On the second rail of the gate, they noticed dirty marks. It looked as though someone had climbed over the fence. The shoe prints were clear enough to be analyzed. Near the gate, detectives found a small plastic bag that had once contained a disposable scalpel. There was a red stain on the packaging, presumably blood. Experts also found several fingerprints on the gate itself and hoped they would aid the investigation. Soil analysis near the body showed that the girl had been killed at that very spot, as the blood had soaked deep into the ground in staggering amounts. The body hadn't been moved after death. There were no signs of dragging, trampled grass, or dirt. At 2 a.m, the phone rang in the Connell household. Jim answered, his heart gripped by fear. It was the call no parent wants to receive. On the line was a detective from the sheriff's department, his voice steady but heavy with the weight of devastating news. A young woman's body had been found, and they needed someone from the Connell family to identify it. Jim and Kathy silently prayed it wasn't their Julie. Soon, officers arrived at the front door and handed the couple an envelope containing photographs of the deceased girl's body. Jim looked first, the blood draining from his face, his heart shattering into a million pieces. It was Julie. He recognized her immediately, though the image was blurry and grainy. Tears streamed from his eyes, but Jim still couldn't process that his little girl was gone forever. He whispered that it was her, Julie. Now it was Kathy's turn. The mother sat in her daughter's bedroom on her bed when the photos were handed to her. She, too, couldn't hold back tears as she recognized her daughter's familiar features in the battered body. The parents were devastated when the officers gave them the only thing found with Julie, besides her clothes, a 10-cent coin. That was all that remained of the girl. Kathy had taught all her daughters to carry a dime, as it was the cost of a call from a payphone at the time. But sadly, the girl didn't get a chance to use it for some reason. Now, the Connells faced the heartbreaking task of telling their younger daughters, Patricia and Wendy, the crushing news about Julie. 12-year-old Patricia overheard her mother say that her older sister had died, but couldn't fully grasp what it meant or how to move forward. 15-year-old Wendy, the last to see Julie alive, couldn't cope with the grief and guilt. She replayed the final moments of that day in her mind countless times, unable to understand why she hadn't noticed any danger. The loss seemed to shatter the Connell family. Julie had been the glue holding them together. Wendy and Patricia adored their older sister, and each dealt with their grief alone. Jim and Kathy couldn't look at each other, weighed down by the loss. But they were united by one common goal. Now they wanted justice, but their nightmare was only beginning. Julie Connell's body was taken to the coroner's office, where the full horror of the attack became clear. The autopsy painted a gruesome picture of the girl's final hours and underscored the brutality of the crime. The autopsy report was both a source of heartbreak and a critical piece of the investigation puzzle. The medical examiner determined that Julie's cause of death was massive blood loss from 3 deep cuts to her throat. One of them severed her carotid artery, ensuring the attacker that the victim wouldn't survive long. Julie's left wrist was tightly bound with a complex knot. The expert noted that the knot wasn't tied in haste. It was done by someone who likely had experience tying such knots. This detail clearly pointed to a planned attack. There were also ligature marks around her ankles, though no ropes were found at the scene. Additionally, the autopsy revealed clear evidence of non-consensual sexual assault, bruises, and tears. Semen samples were extracted from Julie's body. The medical examiner carefully preserved this material for the future, as DNA analysis in 1984 was still in its infancy. However, technology was advancing. At the time, the semen sample could only be used to compare blood types if a suspect was found. The autopsy results were devastating for the Connell family. The dry, impartial listing of the victim's injuries on paper caused unbearable pain, knowing what Julie had endured. Kathy Connell later said she couldn't stop imagining her daughter's final moments. Jim was more horrified that Julie had been bound, completely at the mercy of this monster. The brutality of the attack suggested the perpetrator was no novice. He may have committed similar attacks before and could do so again. Fear gripped the San Leandro community. The Connell story seemed unthinkable, as residents had always felt safe before. After Julie's case, parents stopped letting their children play outside alone. Kennedy Park, a beloved spot for picnics and relaxation, became a stark reminder of the tragedy that unfolded there. It wasn't just a tragedy, but a warning that this could happen to anyone. The investigation into the attack on a high schooler in broad daylight in a public park moved painfully slowly. The police had no DNA databases or ways to track someone's phone, as cell phones didn't exist yet. Everything depended on witness statements, physical evidence, and luck. Statistically, if a case didn't progress within the first few weeks, it became a cold case. Julie disappeared in one place, and her body was found in another. Because the areas fell under different police jurisdictions, this caused confusion and delays in the investigation. Authorities argued over who should take the lead. As a result, detectives from both agencies worked on the case simultaneously, but interagency disputes slowed the exchange of information. From the start, the Connell family painfully endured all the bureaucratic red tape. They felt the authorities had wasted precious time by initially refusing to allocate resources to search for Julie. The parents saw this as neglect of their daughter's life. As the investigation dragged on, the frustration of the grieving parents only grew. Detectives tried to retrace Julie's final steps that day. They scoured Kennedy Park, but found no evidence. The next step was questioning those present in the park that day. Julie's sister, Wendy, the last to see her, said she left around 1 o'clock. Julie was calmly sitting on her blanket with a book, surrounded by families enjoying the beautiful weather. Other park visitors confirmed seeing Julie, but no one heard screams or noticed anything suspicious. The investigation hit a dead end. Detectives decided to try something unconventional. They recreated Julie's last known moments and convinced local media to publicize it. The police hoped the reenactment might jog someone's memory and help solve the case. 15-year-old Wendy agreed to take her older sister's place. She was dressed in a similar lavender shirt and blue jeans and sat in the same spot in the park where Julie had been. The reenactment drew media attention. Nothing like it had been done before, so Wendy, portraying her deceased sister, was filmed by multiple cameras. The police's unexpected tactic worked and proved pivotal in solving the case, as investigators received a call. The manager of a nearby department store contacted the police. He reported that on the day Julie disappeared, the store had held an Easter party for employees in the park. This lead prompted detectives to question everyone who attended the event. They hoped to gather more information about the girl's disappearance from Kennedy Park. One employee recalled seeing Julie from a mini train that circled the park. The ride lasted only a few minutes, but when the train returned, the girl was no longer on her blanket. Detectives also collected photos taken during the event in the park. The pictures captured various moments of the day, including the staff's arrival, setup, an ice cream and barbecue party, and even an Easter egg hunt. One photo, taken around noon, showed the spot where Julie was sitting. Unfortunately, nothing new was uncovered. By then, forensic experts had finished analyzing fingerprints on the gate, and that too was a disappointment. All of them belonged to the ranch owners where Julie's body was found. The dirty mark on the rail also yielded no direct matches. Even the scalpel packaging belonged to the ranch owners. This left detectives in despair. Although DNA technology in 1984 was severely limited, the sample allowed forensic experts to determine some basic traits of the attacker, including his blood type and the fact that he had reddish blonde hair. With no other leads, detectives began investigating whether similar knot-tying techniques appeared in other unsolved crimes. Several similar attacks on teenage girls had occurred recently. These cases bore chilling similarities to the crime against Julie, and detectives wondered if one person was responsible. To explore this possibility, the county sheriff formed a task force to investigate connections between these cases. Detectives examined every detail, the location of the attacks, the nature of the victim's wounds, and so on. But despite their efforts, no solid connections were found. It seemed Julie's murder was a singular act of violence. At least, at that stage, no one could prove otherwise. The lack of progress weighed heavily on Julie's family. Jim and Kathy Connell, tirelessly seeking justice for their daughter, grew weary and disillusioned. Constant media appearances and long nights replaying Julie's final moments in their minds took a toll. The crushing burden of not knowing was exhausting. For Wendy and Patricia, their older sister's tragic death cast a shadow over every aspect of their lives. Wendy later admitted that participating in the reenactment was both an honor and a burden. On one hand, it helped keep her sister's memory alive. On the other, it forced her to relive the trauma. For Patricia, every memory of Julie was like a blow to the chest. She couldn't look at her sister's books or listen to her favorite songs without crying. A month after Julie's death, the Connells began receiving threatening phone calls. They usually came late at night, directed at the entire family, but especially Julie's younger sisters, Wendy and Patricia. The caller whispered that he knew their sister and threatened to do the same to them. The Connell family was terrified by these calls and immediately contacted the police. To identify the anonymous caller, detectives traced the call to a specific person. To their disappointment and surprise, it was just a prankster who thought it was funny. Although the prankster maliciously intimidated the family, he had no connection to Julie's murder. Time passed, and answers remained elusive. Weeks, months, and years went by, but the investigation didn't move forward. One detective honestly told the parents of the deceased girl that they might never find the killer. Julie's room became a home museum to her memory, a kind of shrine. Her bedroom remained exactly as it was before her disappearance. Her books, trinkets, even the wallet where she carefully kept her money, all remained untouched, a painful reminder of the life Julie left behind. The initial community support gradually faded, though the Connell family's emotional wound still hadn't healed. They didn't want their daughter's case to gather dust in the archives and kept fighting for justice, even as the trail went cold. Over a decade passed, potential leads fizzled out, suspects came and went, and investigators had nothing but unanswered questions. By the late 1990s, it seemed Julie Connell's case would join countless unsolved cases forgotten by all. At the time, no one knew that science was slowly catching up to the killer. The DNA sample taken from Julie's body during the autopsy became the key to unraveling the mystery that haunted them for years. The creation of the Combined DNA Index System, CODIS, allowed law enforcement to compare DNA profiles from crime scenes with a national database of offenders, and suddenly, cases thought hopeless were solved. 14 years after Julie Connell's death, the district attorney's office decided to reopen her case. They sent the frozen DNA samples collected from the victim's body for analysis. It was a long and meticulous process. The frozen samples were fragile after so many years of storage. They had to be carefully prepared to avoid contamination or destruction. District Attorney Angela Backers, learning that the evidence from Julie's body didn't match anything in the CODIS database, was still determined to identify the killer who took the young girl's life. She turned to a friend, a renowned forensic scientist, who had developed a unique system for comparing old DNA samples. After weeks of waiting, the results came in, and a match was finally found. The DNA belonged to a convicted criminal already on death row in a California prison. His name was Robert Boyd Rhodes. Robert had never been a suspect in Julie's murder. He hadn't even been on the police's radar. However, Rhodes had a lengthy criminal history. By the time his name was linked to the attack on Connell, Robert was already infamous for another heinous crime. In 1996, he kidnapped, tortured, and killed 8-year-old Michael Lyons in Yuba City, California. The crime was so horrific, it made national headlines. The 8-year-old boy vanished while walking home from school. He lived with his mother, Sandra, his stepfather, and 2 younger sisters. The family resided in an apartment about a mile from the school. Sandra was a homemaker, and Michael's stepfather worked as a painter. They were hardworking people. Michael Lyons was known for his friendly demeanor. His classmates loved him. He often stayed after school to help teachers and always cracked jokes to lift everyone's spirits. One of Michael's neighbors later told the FBI he saw the boy walking home from school. Lyons lingered at a park between the fairgrounds and his home to play for a bit. The witness noticed a man approach the child, talk to him, and then put him in a truck and drive off. Since the boy didn't resist, the neighbor assumed they knew each other and didn't raise the alarm in time. But what could an 8-year-old boy do against a grown man? Less than 24 hours after the abduction, Michael Lyons' body was found in dense brush along a river. Officers immediately knew the boy had been killed. His body bore over 70 shallow stab wounds inflicted with a filleting knife. The nature of the wounds indicated the victim had been tortured. For several hours, Michael remained alive, enduring excruciating pain. However, the cause of death was a stab wound to the neck and back that severed his spinal cord. In his hand, Michael clutched a small silver bracelet. It must have been his only comfort in his final moments. Detectives also found signs of sexual assault. Lyons was naked from the waist down, with his dark green sweater pulled over his head. Nearby, on the riverbank, lay a blood-stained blanket. Robert Boyd Rhodes was caught by police when his truck got stuck in the mud about a kilometer from where Michael Lyons' body was found. When officers approached, he sat motionless in the driver's seat, shirtless, in wet jeans, and barefoot. His behavior was eerily calm, but his presence in the area was highly suspicious. Upon further inspection, police found a tow cable attached to a winch, wrapped around the truck's rear axle and tied to a tree. On the open tailgate lay a fishing knife with a thin, serrated blade. Between the blade and handle were traces of blood and river mud. DNA analysis later confirmed the blood belonged to Michael Lyons. When Robert was arrested, detectives learned he worked as a barber and lived in a small town called Sutter. But further investigation revealed his photo was in a list of 892 offenders who had committed crimes against minors. This was meant to protect society from monsters like him. Of course, this wasn't a very effective way to inform people who to watch out for in their neighborhood. With the advent of the internet, things became much easier. Michael's loss changed his family's life. The boy's mother, Sandra, called her son a ray of sunshine. He was a cheerful 8-year-old, and his senseless death at the hands of a heartless maniac shocked the world. Sandra later recounted how she sat alone for hours, thinking about the 10 hours of torture Michael endured. She couldn't stop imagining the pain her son suffered in those horrific moments. It took years for the emotional wound of losing her child to even begin to heal. Everything turned upside down. A mother's heart was torn from her chest, and Sandra had to learn to live with that pain. The emotional devastation didn't only affect the mother. Sandra's husband, Michael's stepfather, began drinking heavily to cope with the grief. Her younger daughters couldn't understand why their brother was no longer with them. Michael's youngest sister, Alethea, who was only 5 at the time, later said she spent months sitting on the porch steps, waiting for Michael to come home from school, wrapped in his favorite Spider-Man blanket. The day Michael Lyons died, every member of his family died in their own way. Sandra's grief over losing her son could have consumed her entirely, but the woman found the strength to fight. She dedicated herself to activism, transforming her pain into protecting other families from such nightmares. Sandra became a fierce advocate for laws targeting criminals. The mother who lost her child tirelessly educated other parents on how to protect their children. She often spoke at schools, warning students about the dangers strangers could pose. Sandra's advocacy extended far beyond her local community. She spoke before lawmakers, participated in rallies, and collaborated with other parents who had lost children to violent crimes. In memory of her son, Sandra founded the Michael Lyons Foundation, which raises awareness about crimes against children and supports victims' families. But all this came after Robert had already committed a series of crimes and was now linked to Julie Connell's murder. In 1985, just a year after Julie's death, Rhodes attacked another woman. He broke into her home, held her at gunpoint, handcuffed her to a pipe, and assaulted her. Then, with her bound, he put her in his truck and drove toward a river. In a desperate bid to survive, the woman managed to jump out of the moving vehicle. When Robert backed up, intending to run her over, she rolled to the side of the road, got up, and ran to the nearest building for help. Robert was arrested and convicted of kidnapping and sexual assault. For some reason, Rhodes didn't stay in prison long. As soon as he was released, he returned to his old habits. In 1993, he assaulted the 4-year-old granddaughter of a woman he was dating at the time. This crime led to another conviction for lewd acts with a minor. Despite his convictions, Rhodes remained free for much of his life. After the murder of Michael Lyons, he was finally sentenced to death in 1999. In 2002, his DNA matched the semen samples taken from Julie's body in 1984. The prosecutor and the prosecution team weren't confident they could secure a conviction against Robert based solely on DNA evidence. Rhodes' attorney could easily claim the sexual act between his client and the victim was consensual. So detectives needed to find something else linking him to Julie's death. No one was as invested in the case as the Connell family and district attorney.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Angela Backers. She pieced together evidence, dedicating all her time to it. Her efforts soon paid off. Angela found one of Robert's former girlfriends from 1984. This ex-girlfriend revealed two crucial details. First, Rhodes lived less than a block from Kennedy Park, where Julie was last seen. Second, at the time, he drove a green truck. This vehicle led Angela to consider that the perpetrator might have parked near Kennedy Park. Backers retrieved old photos collected from department store employees who held the outdoor Easter party. Armed with a magnifying glass, she examined each photo inch by inch, looking for a green vehicle near the park. In one blurry, low-quality photo, Angela spotted a green truck. Then she looked down and couldn't believe her eyes. Just a few meters from the truck, sitting on a blanket, was Julie Connell. It was hard to make out details, but the lavender color of her shirt confirmed the obvious. This was the connection they were looking for. All the evidence combined allowed the district attorney to charge Robert Boyd Rhodes with Julie Connell's murder. In 2007, 23 years after the girl's death, the case went to trial. By then, Rhodes was already on death row for Michael Lyons' murder, but prosecutors were determined to hold him accountable for Julie's death as well. According to the prosecution, after Connell finished studying, she packed her things in her backpack and was ready to head home. No one knew exactly what happened next, but Robert somehow convinced the girl to approach his truck, then grabbed her and dragged her inside. He likely watched Julie from his vehicle. The defendant's attorney, knowing the DNA evidence would be critical to the prosecution's case, claimed that 31-year-old Robert Rhodes and 18-year-old Julie Connell were in a romantic relationship. Robert's sister even testified, saying she saw them together and described them as a couple. It's unclear why she tried to protect her brother, who was already sentenced to death. The claim shocked and outraged Julie's family. What could connect a diligent high schooler with an adult man who had broken the law multiple times? The defense's argument was not only absurd, but deeply offensive to Julie's memory. The trial was exhausting for the Connell family. They had to relive every detail of their daughter and sister's tragic death. After 4 weeks of testimony, the jury deliberated for less than an hour before reaching a verdict. Robert Boyd Rhodes was found guilty of Julie Connell's murder and sentenced to death. In the end, Rhodes became one of the few people in California to receive multiple death sentences. Kennedy Park, once a place of joy, became a place of sorrow and a symbol of resilience. A memorial bench was installed there in honor of the slain girl, a reminder that she was more than just a victim. Julie Connell was a daughter, a sister, and a bright light extinguished too soon. Though justice was served and the verdict brought a sense of closure, it didn't end the grief of her parents and sisters. They kept asking themselves questions. Who would Julie have become if she hadn't died? Who would she have married? What heights would she have reached in her life? Sadly, they'll never know, because Robert Rhodes stole Julie's future. This story reminds us of the fragility of life and teaches us never to give up. The Connell family's decades-long fight for justice, their persistence, and their refusal to let Julie's case be forgotten are powerful lessons in courage and hope for everyone else. If you have finished watching, you are a real fan of true crime. Subscribe to the channel, turn on the bell notifications, and put the like. See you in the next video.